Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does our architecture say about our lives and our values? Far beyond providing us shelter from the elements, the structures we build and inhabit shape our everyday environments, our view of the world, and even our interactions with other people and our own ideas. And while discussions of the built environment often center around beautiful and ambitious designs, New Yorker architecture critic Paul Goldberger argues that our daily experiences in average buildings may be the most revealing and important of all. His new book is called Why Architecture Matters, and he's here with us to talk about it. Paul, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Good to be here, Chris.
You write that if we think that things are simple, black and white, we will never really get architecture. What do you mean by that statement?
What I mean is that architecture is many things at once. That's its difficulty, but also kind of its glory. You know, it's an art, but it's not an art. It has a practical function, yet it's something more than practical. It involves emotions. It involves our social lives, our cultural life, our financial and economic life. You know, a building is a thing in society that we all have to deal with, as well as a piece of art, and it affects us in every possible way.
You write here about the fact that at any given time in history, there has been a common architectural language between buildings. For example, grand manor houses had some similarities to modest homes of a particular time, and then tenement slums had some relationship to those modest homes. What do we learn by studying that language?
Well, I think what we learn is just the idea that architecture can be a language. You know, it's a language by which people speak to each other. It's a language by which generations speak to each other over time. You know, a city, one of the most beautiful things ever said about cities was Lewis Mumford once wrote, in a city, time becomes visible. And the idea that architecture gives us layers of time in cities, I think, is a very wonderful way to look at it.
What obligation do you think contemporary architects have to the work of those who have come before them, and what obligation do they have to consider who might come after them?
Well, architecture always connects to some extent to what happened before, what happened afterwards. Architects learn, of course, from the past. Sometimes they may choose to imitate the past pretty directly, but that's hardly necessary. Sometimes it's better not to, in fact. But architecture is a little bit about other architecture in the same way that art is sometimes, at least partly, about other art. Building is itself a kind of commitment to the future. We build because we care what will follow us. We shouldn't be building simply for a 20-year depreciation period that the tax law gives us, something like that. Our buildings are much more lasting things in the world.
Is it, do you think, though, a noble goal for architects to strive in their designs for something that is entirely timeless, or ultimately is that folly most of the time?
Well, every building can't be a timeless masterwork. It's not possible. We don't have the resources for it. Different buildings have different purposes, and some of them are much more mundane. But every building should at least be designed with a recognition that it has a public role as well as a private role, and that those of us who simply pass it walking along the street or driving on the expressway or passing it in the car in some other way, have some relationship to it, and it affects all of us. And the more we can design with an acknowledgement of that, I think the better our architecture will be.
It's a really fascinating thing to think about, Paul, because architecture that we might pass by every day, we might never see what's inside, whether that's houses in our neighborhoods or office buildings on the way to work. And either way, though, our personal landscape is formed by things that contain all this mystery.
Absolutely. Our personal landscape is formed by all kinds of things that we didn't choose ourselves. They're there. We didn't put them there. We didn't select them. And as you say, we may never get inside them. So they're part mystery as well. I mean, buildings in that sense are like people. They have exteriors. And then when you get to know them, you know the interior. But I'm sure there are plenty of people who know you who don't know you well and don't know your interior. And that's okay, you know, but as long as some other people do, so forth.
How does it affect our understanding of architecture as art that we don't interact with buildings by choice most of the time, in the same way that we would, say, go to a museum to see a sculpture or a painting, or
right,
we would go to a film to see a theater?
Well, when we approach architecture as art, usually then it is much more intentional. It is like going to see, going to a concert, going to a museum, and so forth. And there's plenty of architecture that deserves to be approached that way. But a lot of architecture is more like background music that we just hear all the time, whether we chose to or not. And it affects us in a number of ways. I mean, one of the key ways, I think, is that it creates a sort of a sense that we can adjust to architecture in a way that we don't always adjust to other things. We learn to tune it out slightly, because if it's no good, we're stuck with it. And it's not, you know, you can't listen to a piece of music you hate all the time. But if you see a building every day that you hate, you've got to kind of somehow make a peace with it, I think. You may not love it, and you shouldn't love it, but you learn to kind of tolerate it, I guess is maybe the best word.
Well, one thing that's really sort of tantalizing about the ideas that you present here is this insistence that we get an incomplete picture if we're only paying attention to the so-called important buildings.
Yes.
Why, though, do we not even notice the strip malls and parking garages and mediocre office buildings where most of us spend much of our lives?
Well, you know, a lot of them aren't worthy of too much attention.
Yeah.
And part of the reason I'm arguing that we should pay more attention to them is the hopes that we can gradually make them better. The more people who get attuned to architecture, the bigger the demand for decent architecture will be. And ultimately, if we can improve, you know, if we can improve the state of all of our architecture by 5 or 10%, that will have a greater impact on the quality of life than building a few more masterpieces here and there. I've always argued that we're better at building really special buildings than we are at building ordinary buildings that bring pleasure and satisfaction. That's really the great challenge today. You know, I think 75, 100 years ago, they knew how to do that. If you look at the ordinary houses or the buildings of a main street in a small town or village from 1910, 1920, 1930, they're all actually pretty decent. They're kind of nice. Somehow we've lost the ability to do the equivalent of those buildings today. That's really we can do really special things. I mean, Dallas has a lot of really remarkable and important buildings, but we haven't figured out how to do the ordinary stuff well.
When you talk about the ordinary, you have some interesting writing here about how bank buildings have changed, how, you know, 50 years ago or 100 years ago, you knew you were walking into a bank.
Yes, absolutely. Well, banks 100 years ago had to convince you that your cash was safe. And so they were designed usually as sort of great stone buildings influenced by classical architecture or Renaissance palazzos and so forth, so that these great temples gave you this feeling that you put your cash there, you knew it was safe and would be taken care of, and this was an institution that whose roots went way, way back in time, even if they didn't truly. And now, of course, banks are altogether different things. Cash is something you get out of a machine, and most banking transactions are really electronic transactions, little blips in the computer of electronic deposits and electronic debits and so forth. So what kind of architecture expresses that? We're still trying to figure that out, actually.
Well, so many people are doing their banking entirely online.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So bank is home in a way. You know, your bank is your own desk for a lot of people. For me, most of the time, it is too. That's right.
Well, there have been a lot of conversations in the past few years about whether the growth of online culture magnifies our need for a sense of place or eliminates it. Where do you fall on that question?
I would say it magnifies our need for it. What it has done is make real place all the more special. And I think that's great. I mean, there's an awful lot of transactions can be done better online and should be. But it makes being physically present in a real place all the more important and all the more special. You know, people thought that mail order as well as internet shopping would be the end of retail. But in fact, of course, it isn't. The store has come back big time by providing something in the realm of real experience that you can't get online. And so, too, with real cities and real communities and real places and real architecture. They give us an experience that we cannot get in another way. I think that's also been very much behind the boom in the museum, seeing all kinds of works of art online has not diminished the experience of going to a museum and seeing the real thing. It's enhanced it, and it makes the authentic thing all the more precious in a way.
So you're already familiar with it by sort of studying up before you actually enter the building.
And you know what you're going to see, and you get excited about it, or you don't. You don't bother to see it, but that's a different matter. But in general, I mean, you know what a big thing museums are today in our culture. That would seem to go completely against the whole idea of the Internet and that kind of connection, but it hasn't.
Since we're talking about museums, we can't fail to mention that Ayempé's pyramid at the Louvre turned 20 this week. And that's such a fascinating story to me because initially when it was built, Parisians seemed to universally hate it, and now they love it, and it's this big source of pride. What accounts for the change beyond the inherent beauty of the building?
Well, I think it's a number of things. I mean, new things can often be very shocking at the beginning, and they very often go through a period of being acutely disliked. And you can't underestimate the extent to which buildings change over time. It's one of the things I talk about in the book, and our sense of buildings changes over time. You know, Sir John Summerson, the great English architectural historian, once wrote, "I suppose that all architecture has to die before it can touch the historical imagination." In other words, we have to go through a period of kind of hating something before we can give it historical perspective. And I think particularly in Paris, a city that's very, very sensitive to its history, initially the pyramid seemed like a shocking intrusion and almost something kind of vulgar. But as it's been there, as people have lived with it, as they become used to it, as it was no longer shocking, its beauty and strength have emerged. And now, of course, I think people would be shocked and offended if it ever disappeared. It's exactly the opposite.
And I guess that all plays into your idea that a really great building should both comfort and challenge us.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. There's the key way in which architecture is different from other kinds of art. You know, a great painting, while it can be a very beautiful thing, and in that sense is comforting, art really should be challenging us as well. Buildings, though, have to comfort us because we're with them all the time, and their job in part is to take care of us. You know, they keep us out of the rain, and they keep us warm, or keep us cool if it's the hot Texas summer, whatever. But they protect us in one way or another, and they nurture us. And they shelter us, but they need to also challenge us if they're going to be art. And great architecture does by exciting us with new possibilities of space and form.
Paul Goldberger is my guest. He is architecture critic for The New Yorker. His new book is called Why Architecture Matters. We'll resume our conversation in just a couple of minutes, and you can get on the line now to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. If you're interested in checking out Paul's website, it is paulgoldberger.com. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think On KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is architecture critic for The New Yorker, Paul Goldberger. His new book is called Why Architecture Matters. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Going back, Paul, to this notion of good architecture both challenging and comforting us, there are examples of places where we really don't want to be challenged at all. I'm thinking of a medical office building or in many cases, even our homes.
Well, maybe most of all our home, actually. I mean, probably home is the place we most need comfort, most of us, because it's a place we think of as retreating from the world, and that's a perfectly normal and healthy way to look at it. Although, of course, comfort may mean one thing to you and another thing to me and another thing to a third person altogether. So defining comfort is itself a challenge, we might say. A doctor's office, though, should provide comfort of one sort, but on the other hand, it should also needs to look professional, and if it looks contemporary and up to the moment, it can also give you a sense that the doctor's medical knowledge is contemporary and up to the moment. So a lot of buildings always send messages of one kind or another.
How does human interaction within and with architecture ultimately come to determine its meaning?
Well, we get meaning from interacting with architecture. I mean, our most profound way, of course, the basic way is visually. We look at it, and architecture speaks in a certain way. But I think just living in it, there's a visceral reaction, visceral impact that architecture has over time when you see it and when you live with it. But one of the other things I try to say in the book is that architecture affects us through memory. There's a chapter called Architecture and Memory that talks a lot about the buildings we all grew up with and how sometimes your childhood bedroom or your kindergarten classroom may have a more vivid place somewhere in your mind than the office cubicle you go to today. and also how buildings change over time. They physically change, of course, but also our attitude toward them changes as we change and as the culture changes. So it's a whole lot of moving targets all the time, which is another reason it's such a fascinating subject.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Doug in Dallas. Hello, Doug.
How you doing, Chris?
Great, thank you.
I'm sure enjoying your show.
Thank you.
When I think about architecture, I did quite a bit of traveling when I was in the Air Force. Architecture, to me, is a function of place and culture. When I was in foreign cultures overseas, I could look at a building and say, oh, well, I'm in Japan or I'm in Turkey,
right,
or whatever. And even closer to home, though, I can go, for instance, into downtown Dallas and look around and say, oh, well, I'm in the business district. And then go a few miles and look around and say, well, now I'm in a residential district, which is kind of a cultural type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a culture on a large global scope, but then you also have a very small microculture, you might say, of the area within which you live. And I think
that's right.
That point out.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that one of the great challenges we face today is holding on to that. As we move toward more and more globalization, architecture doesn't have the qualities it used to in terms of identifying different cultures and different parts of the world. Japan is now building plenty of buildings that don't look that different from buildings in Dallas. I'm going next month to Dubai to look at the Burj Dubai, the world's tallest building, which was designed by an architect from Chicago. It's in the middle of the desert in Dubai, and it's a lot bigger than anything in Dallas, but I'm not sure it looks fundamentally different. There's nothing about it that says to you the Middle East, except the fact that it got built at all, I guess, these days. But other than that, no. So we don't have as clear a cultural differentiation from our architecture as we once did in this sort of global world we live in.
Does the economy have the same sort of lag effect on architecture? Because a project that was slated to begin at the height of the recession may have been held off. Does it change our ambition in terms of design?
It's fascinating, actually, to think about the impact of the economy on architecture. Of course, it has a huge effect because buildings are the first thing you give up in tough times. You've got to keep eating. You've got to keep putting clothes on. You've got to keep doing certain basic things. But building a new building or renovating a building even is something you're more likely to postpone and something that is less likely to pick up immediately but tends to wait till we're really pretty sure we're out of a bad economic time. Now, there's a lot of wonderful architecture that we connect to bad times, however. In some cases, it's just because buildings take a real long time to happen. You know, the Empire State Building in New York was finished early in the Depression, in the 30s, but it was conceived before the Depression. So it was really a relic of a different time. The Dubai Tower that I mentioned a moment ago is the same thing. I mean, that was conceived in boom times, but it's getting finished in very different times. The extent to which we reconceive architecture during difficult times, though, is a more interesting question. It'll be a real challenge to see how this affects us. In the short term, it's affecting us by simply drastically cutting the amount of buildings we're building. How it affects our thinking in other ways, I think, remains to be seen.
What accounts for our obsession in modern America with large spaces? Our houses are McMansions, our stores are what we call big boxes, which is such an interesting term because you know before you walk in what you're going to get.
Well, we have, it's fascinating. We have moved more and more toward bigger and bigger spaces in the last generation. And I think there is one area in which the economy is definitely changing things because while we're not only building fewer new houses now, the ones we're building tend to be smaller than the ones we were building 5 years ago. So we're heading in the other direction now, and that might be a very positive effect of this difficult time we're in. I think there was just too much money around, and money was loose, money was easy, there was a lot of it, and people said, well, you know, I mean, I could live in 4,000 square feet, but why not live in 6 if I can afford it? And or why not live in 10 or 12 or 15? And everything kind of expanded. I think also technology has tended to raise a lot of expectations in our culture overall. You know, when I grew up in the 50s, I grew up in a comfortable middle-class suburban town in New Jersey in a very comfortable house. But there was one bathroom. We had one family car, and I think we had one telephone line. Now, a middle-class family today would consider itself poor and as if would believe it had been ejected from the middle class today if it had one telephone line, one bathroom, and one car. So our level of expectation has changed hugely in the last generation, and the extra size, extra square footage that has come onto houses, I think is just a part and parcel of that same change.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Paul Goldberger, whose new book is called Why Architecture Matters. Let's go next on the line to David in Dallas. Hello, David.
Yes, hi. When I've been listening to you, I have that picture in my mind of those guys at Rockefeller Plaza, you know, sitting there on the beams eating lunch, and it was during the Depression, and it was a time when, you know, everything was bad. And I was going to ask, you know, is there something in the way of architecture or way of buildings right now that's sending a message that things will get better? Because here we are in the worst recession since that time, and I'll take the answer offline.
Thanks for your call.
Well, that's a great question. And in fact, when I mentioned the Empire State Building, I was about to mention Rockefeller Center, too, because it's an interesting but very different example, different side of history. It was really, you know, John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s project to help keep the economy going. It was a time when a rich American could, in effect, create his own stimulus package and make it happen. I don't know that we can do that today. I hope that some of the government plans for more infrastructure investment will have some of that effect. But I don't think we're going to be building the kind of project Rockefeller Center represented, which was a huge office and shopping and entertainment complex in the heart of a city, in large part because during the boom years we built so many of those that we really have a huge excess of space, and we can't really justify doing more even if it was free because we've got to fill up the stuff we have first. So we're not going to see the things just like Rockefeller Center, but Rockefeller Center was, in fact, historically a great example and a very rare example of an individual's own stimulus package that had a profound effect on New York. It was also turned out to be a great piece of architecture.
You've been writing about architecture for decades now, but I wonder if the way you look at a building today is the same as when you started out.
What a really interesting question. I think it's the same. This book, in part, Why Architecture Matters, is in part about looking at buildings and how I look at buildings and what issues matter to me. And it's really organized, in fact, in ways of thinking about buildings as opposed to history or chronology or architectural style or anything like that. And I think my own, I've always been very interested in how a building feels. That's why I will never write about anything I haven't physically been to. And I think I've always instinctively seen it that way. Probably over the years I've gotten a little more sure of myself as I've seen more and more buildings and been doing it for longer. But the interest has always been the same, I think, which is what does it actually feel like when you're standing in front of it and standing inside it, as well as, of course, how well does it work and how does it connect to its neighbors and how does it connect to the history of architecture? All those things are important as well. But my own instinctive first question is, what does it feel like? And I think that's been that way pretty much all the way through. If there's any other change that's happened in the many years I've been looking at buildings, that I think I used to be, I've always been sympathetic to good intentions on the part of architects. But I think I've gotten a little less patient with them. So if somebody's trying to do the right thing and describes it in convincing terms, but the reality of the building still just doesn't feel right, doesn't feel good and convincing to me, I'm likely to be a little less positive about it than I would have been a few years ago, maybe.
It's really telling that you insist on physically being in and around and outside a building before you want to write about it, because there is more to it than just seeing it with your eyes. There's the sound of footsteps walking down a hall, and there's the temperature of the air and all of those things that wouldn't seem to matter so much.
You're absolutely right. I mean, first, we do perceive buildings more than just visually. They connect to all of our senses, or almost all of our senses. I guess we don't eat them, but they connect to most of our other senses in one way or another. But you also don't understand the context of a building, the surroundings, too well until you're standing there in front of it and in it. And the other thing that is very tough, probably impossible to capture except by physically being there, is space. And architecture is as much about the space created within as it is about the actual physical structure that's doing the creating. And you don't feel space in two-dimensional photographs at all.
What, speaking again about context, talk about the decisions that architects make in terms of relating a building to the space around it, whether it's going to be very similar or very different or reflect in really subtle ways what else is out there.
Sure. Well, I think a building has to acknowledge what's around it. I think that's a key part of designing well. But respecting surroundings doesn't have to mean imitating them. There are a lot of different ways to do it. I think one of the most profoundly beautiful and subtle buildings of our time in terms of fitting into context is Frank Gehry's famous museum, Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain, which is that enormous structure of swooping, curving pieces of titanium doesn't look anything like anything around it, of course, because it doesn't look much like anything else anywhere except some of Frank Gehry's other work. But it does fit in a remarkable way because the shapes allude to the way you approach the building, and it's on the river, and there's a huge bridge nearby, and everything about it is, in fact, shaped with a recognition of what's there. Respect for context does not in any way have to mean imitating it directly, and sometimes, in fact, imitating is the least interesting and dullest way in which a building can fit in. It's much more exciting to see an architect choose to fit in a more creative way.
I have not been to Bilbao, but from the pictures that I've seen, the experience is also really different of the building, depending on whether you approach it from the river or you approach it from the street side.
Yes, absolutely. And ideally, you should approach it both ways because both approaches are exciting and visually powerful, and there's great drama to both of them, and a feeling that the building just belongs right there and could not have been anywhere but that exact piece of earth. That's really the key thing.
Was there the same objection to that building when it first went up 12 years ago that there was to the Louvre Pyramid?
No, it was actually received remarkably positively. I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that Bilbao was a tired city that had invested in the most ambitious program of cultural tourism that I think and cultural urban revival that any city has ever done. And so there was a desire that it should work. And the building just had enormous power and drama to it that people got immediately. And it was not within a beloved landmark that people thought was being tampered with, as with the Louvre.
Paul Goldberger is my guest. He's architecture critic for The New Yorker. His new book is called Why Architecture Matters. You can join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New Yorker architecture critic Paul Goldberger, whose new book is called Why Architecture Matters. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You mentioned earlier that you are less tolerant now of good intentions that don't quite work on the part of the architect. Mm-hmm. What do you think architects ought to consider in their attempts to shape human behavior?
Well, every building is different. Every circumstance is different, of course. And at the end of the day, architecture is a service business, and architects have clients. So the first thing they have to consider is what the client wants. But hopefully they will go beyond that and think of everyone as being at least partly the client of a building, or at least the users of a building. And think about ways in which the building will make life somehow a little pleasanter for people who see it, for people who go into it, all of those things, while still responding to its functional needs. Another thing that I think today architects are honor-bound to pay attention to is sustainability. And, the green architecture movement is with us to stay. I think we're going to see a much more energy responsive generation of buildings going forward at this point.
We We have an email here from Ed who asks if you would comment on architecture that dominates and was intended to dominate. He says, I'm thinking of three examples. One is Empire State Plaza in Albany, which stands in an area that was gutted so it could be built and can be seen for miles. The second is the string of huge castles that the medieval English built along the Welsh coast. The third is Italian fascist architecture. Now they are almost naturalized, but it seems to me, he writes, that they began as sharp interventions to tell the locals who was in charge.
Well, that's a fascinating question, because he's right that a lot of things begin as assertive, almost aggressive interventions, and then over time we become accustomed to them and they feel less like that. That's part of the reason, by the way, that, to go back to your earlier question about the pyramid at the Louvre, that is so much more acceptable to people today, that they just get used to it. You can't underestimate I can't think of a particular technical term for it, but let's call it the get-used-to factor in architecture and the way we adapt to it. It's another thing I talk about in the Buildings and Time chapter in this book. But the particular examples Ed mentions are all a little bit different. I mean, the Empire State Plaza in Albany was an example of a particularly, I think, unconvincing and no longer sustainable way of rebuilding cities, which was to demolish blocks and blocks of them and build a bunch of towers like abstract sculptures on a huge podium, completely disconnected from the street. We're accustomed to it now, so it doesn't shock us in the way it once did, but it's really not the best way to do things, and it did not ultimately help Albany very much, which is still a troubled and somewhat depressed city. The castles on the coast are a different matter, of course, and I think they dominate nature more than anything else, and there are moments when that's appropriate, but thankfully not too many of them, and architecture usually has an obligation, I think, to be more deferential to nature, but every now and then I think it's quite exciting when it isn't. I mean, I think of the Golden Gate Bridge, for example, which is an intervention into nature, but only makes that place more beautiful.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ed in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi. Mr. Goldberger, I'm wondering if your book perhaps deals with what I'm about to discuss, and that is what I perceive as the rampant mediocrity, what I would describe when big box stores and strip shopping centers were mentioned earlier as examples of local architecture. I would call that an example of a lack of architecture. And I've gotten to the point where I'm so disappointed, and I would describe it as disgusted by this phenomenon that's so rampant in North Texas, if not the entire United States, and particularly in the residential areas thereof, that I'm really seriously beginning to investigate looking at spending the last 30 years or so of my life in retiring to France, because I perceive that they haven't succumbed to this.
Right.
And so I wonder if, assuming you agree with that, maybe you don't, it was a phenomenon that was previously so eloquently described by an author, I believe his name is Rybczynski, in the geography of nowhere.
Retold Rybczynski, yes. Yeah.
And so I wonder if one of the solutions so that we don't continue down this horrendous road is would be not the requiring two things, the requiring of arts education as being a part of continuous part of every elementary school education, every child's elementary school education. Every year there would be a significant component developed devoted to art in general, and at some point a significant component of that would seem to ought to be architecture, insightful study of architecture.
What do you think about that, Paul?
Well, I'd certainly like to see more education in art and architecture and so forth. I'm all for it. I think the problem we're talking about is a bigger one, though. And I'm glad you brought big box stores back onto the table, because I think I let that comment slip by a few minutes ago and didn't really address it. It's really an issue about planning and our attitude toward how we build and how we make communities. And are we going to let the automobile, great, wonderful thing that it is, determine everything about how we make places? And I think it's a terrible mistake to do so. If there's anything I've learned in all these years of doing this stuff, and this may seem strange for an architecture critic to say, it's that in most cities and towns and small villages even, streets are more important than villages. And the streets are more important than buildings, rather. I mean, streets are more important than buildings. And in fact, big box stores have nothing to do with streets. They're all about ignoring streets, and people come and drive down freeways and then park in vast expanses of parking lot and go into this huge box and get back into their car. Well, that's very destructive to the whole sense of place. And the big box store is only part of that much larger set of structures. And by structures, I'm talking about political and planning structures as much as physical structures that gives us this whole landscape. It's really a problem with the sprawl landscape of our culture. I hope you don't give up and go to France. I mean, we need people like you here continuing to argue and fight these battles. There are places, and I say with all great respect for Texas, where they've built an awful lot of wonderful buildings over the years and has probably as much great museum architecture as any single state in the country, there's also probably more urban sprawl than anywhere else. And there are other parts of the country, I think, that have been a little bit tougher in dealing with this and have said that maintaining a more traditional urban fabric is a priority.
Have you been here lately? Have you seen the Arts District since it's been completed?
I have not been there in the last year or so. I hope to go in the next couple of months, but I've certainly seen the Arts District in its earlier phases, but I have not been since the new Opera House opened. No, I'm very eager to see it.
Yeah, it's spectacular, especially at night.
Well, I'm a great admirer of Norman Foster, who did it, so I have high expectations for it.
Let's go next on the line to Reggie in Dallas. Hi, Reggie.
Yeah, hi. Paul.
Hi.
You know, I was, this is leaping back to something you had talked about earlier. I've had three notable architectural experiences versus a 2D, mm-hmm. two-dimensional
yeah.
Photographic experience that I've pieces I've never seen, you know, you don't get the feeling at all. I mean, one is Louis Kahn's Exeter Library,
mm-hmm.
Gaudí in Barcelona, and the temple complex at Thebes, modern Luxor.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering what, if you have any specific pieces that, you know, you just can't understand unless you're there. You know, I never got Gaudí until I was actually there. And I was just wondering what your favorite ones were.
Well, there are several, and the ones you've mentioned are definitely on my list. And in fact, Louis Kahn in general is. The Exeter Library is one example, but in Fort Worth, of course, the Kimball Museum is another. And the Salk Institute in La Jolla in California is another that is absolutely extraordinary, and you don't get it till you're there. I think for me, the University of Virginia, the main campus, the original campus section done by Thomas Jefferson, is that kind of thing. I didn't quite understand how great it was. I thought it was just a bunch of little brick classical buildings with an imitation of the Pantheon at one end. I didn't understand that it's actually one of the most profoundly beautiful and moving spaces in America. Frank Lloyd Wright's Unity Temple is another, his Unitarian church outside of Chicago. I always knew it was okay, but it just blew me away when I finally got inside and was inside that space and felt it. Certainly, the great cathedrals of Europe, many of them, Chartres most of all, fall into that category, that you don't get it till you're there. But I think also, to tie what you've just been saying to something I was saying a moment ago, the whole feel of a street in a great city you don't quite get till you're walking, till your own shoe leather is hitting the pavement. you know, to walk down a street in Paris or in Rome or Barcelona, to go back to Gaudí, who you mentioned, you don't quite get that feel till you're there. And that's one of the great pleasures of architecture, too.
What's amazing about that experience, too, is that it creates this sort of permanent tie between you and this place that you may only be in for a few days at a time.
Yes. And it means the second visit is actually in some ways even better. It's often a mistake to say, I've been there, don't need to go back, because if you go back, you then have the added layer of memory about a place, which actually makes it just richer and deeper and kind of resonates in a whole other way.
Having already spoken about the fact that, you know, there are buildings in Dubai and Tokyo and Paris and everywhere else that are built by architects who are from all over the world, is there a particular country or culture that is really doing interesting things now as compared with peers in other countries?
Well, a lot of really extraordinary stuff has been built in China in the last few years, much of it for the Olympics in Beijing, but some of it elsewhere. You know, the Chinese are investing so much money in so much stuff, much of which is being done by distinguished architects from the United States, in fact, and Europe. So I would have to put China, whatever we may think of it, I'd have to put it on such a list. Japan has over the years, a little less recently. And, you know, we do keep trying in this country, I have to say. I mean, it's we're not going to see much in the next few years because of the economy, but we've done some pretty good stuff in the last decade, Texas included.
What do you recommend we all do the next time we set foot in a space that means something to us personally, whether it's our home or maybe the place we work or the place we worship?
Well, I think to stop, think, and kind of drink it in, take it in. If it's worthwhile sometimes in life to stop and smell the roses, stop and feel the space as well, and stop and look. You know, this book, as much as anything else, is about looking and about the value of looking and how much it can make life more fun.
And the last thing I want to ask you about is, as cities evolve and grow, what should we think about in deciding which buildings to raise and which ones to preserve and which ones to renovate?
Well, I think we ultimately need a balance. A city that tries to freeze itself completely will die, because cities are not museums. They're living, organic places, and they have to grow and change. But we've got to preserve the best of what we've had, partly because cities are more meaningful if they represent layers of time. As I said much earlier, quoting Lewis Mumford, saying, in a city, time becomes visible. You can't lose that. I think it's a combination of things. Architectural quality, of course, is key. You know, a great building should be protected no matter what.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time.
Okay.
Paul Goldberger is architecture critic for The New Yorker, and his new book is called Why Architecture Matters. Paul, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been fun for me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis, and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.